I joined in 1978. I was a Boy Scout, and I'd always looked towards the forces as a career, and I wanted to join either the Army or the Royal Navy.
Obviously, back in 1978, the late 70s, the early 80s, a posting to Northern Ireland was something that I expect would have brought with it a degree of uncertainty and a degree maybe of, well, maybe fear is the wrong word, but certainly maybe dread.
Fear was definitely the right word to use. I was first posted to Northern Ireland in 1980, right in the middle of the hunger strikes with Bobby Sands. And I remember my first experience of landing at Aldergrove Airport was, believe it or not, I was expecting to see terrorists sitting in trees taking pot shots at me. That's how naive I was at the time, because I'd literally just turned 17, and I was told by my regimental sergeant major back in Colchester, "Taffy, you're going to Northern Ireland." "Oh, right, sir. When?" "Tomorrow." So, yes, there was a lot of trepidation because obviously we'd heard and seen, as a young soldier, literally under 18, I knew nothing about the history of Northern Ireland. So all I knew was that I was going out there to do a job I was trained for as a medic, to go out on the streets and do what I was trained for.
And when you arrived, I mean, you had this perception. What are your early memories?
Lots of hostility between soldiers and what I then believed to be the Catholics, but later on I learned it was obviously the IRA and their movement. A lot of hostilities, a lot of shootings, a lot of bombings, being called out to these incidents, not knowing exactly what you're going to see. But as my training as a paramedic goes, my job was literally to go out there and literally pick up the bits and pieces. And if we had bodies that were injured, then yes, we tried to save them, as you do. And these weren't just military, this was civilian as well. Civilian people being caught up in the bomb blasts and the crossfire and things like that. So you encounter that every day. You encounter the hostility and the riots and things like that. But you just take it as a normal day, even though you don't know what the true meaning of what is going on in Northern Ireland as a young soldier.
You know, we're talking about limbs here, probably, of people who have been caught up in these explosions at the time. Can you remember the first time you were faced with that scene after you'd arrived in Northern Ireland?
The first time was probably, I remember, I was working in Musgrave Park Hospital, and the first body I ever came across, I think, was a Royal Marine who'd been shot three times. Yes, he had a flak jacket on, but those times in the late 70s, we had the old flak jackets that had the plate in the front, small 4x6-inch plate. And this chap had been shot, I think it was twice on the right-hand side of his body and once in the abdomen. And literally, to coin a phrase, his guts were spilling out. And it was a case of trying to keep him alive as best we could. And that was probably, from as far as I can remember, my first experience of dealing with any sort of traumatic injury in Northern Ireland. And as time went on and I ended up going out on the streets, you come across places like the Europa Hotel, which was being bombed on a regular basis. And even though, yes, the IRA did give warnings, people were often caught up in the bomb blasts, both military and civilian. And obviously, I wasn't involved in any of the major events in the middle of Belfast. Mine was obviously at a later time, in 1982, when I was posted down to Ballykelly. But yes, came across an awful lot of trauma, for want of a better phrase.
We'll come to the drop and well bombing a little bit later, but I want to ask you before that, just to give me an idea of of how you could ever be prepared to be involved in an incident like that. I mean, do you become immune to these situations at any point? How do you detach what would be maybe the natural personal instincts when you would be involved in situations like this? As you say, when you're coming across, you know, people who have been involved in some terrible, terrible atrocities.
The first thing you have to do is, number one, be professional. You're trained. I was trained primarily as a soldier. That's your first training. You're trained as a soldier to kill. My secondary training is as a paramedic. I am trained to save life. And the only time I can use, for example, my weapon is in the defense of casualties. And that is a thing that you don't think about. What I used to have to think about was an incident comes in over the radio, you switch on, you're going out to deal with whatever faces you out there, whether it's one person or 20 people, you have to be totally professional, because what you have to do is you have to put your paramedic brain straight into first gear. And within a matter of seconds, you're into fifth, you're into sixth gear, because you're triaging the casualties that you come across. Those that are the most severe, they obviously get treated immediately, and you just switch off to everything. You are aware to your security around you, but that's where you rely on not only the RUC, as it was at the time, but also your fellow comrades, your fellow buddies in the army that you're working with. You're there to do a job. My job is out there on the street saving life, and that's what I've got to do. But at the same time, I also have to protect my fellow soldiers as well. So you're constantly on alert, but on the medical side, that is my priority, is to go out and save life. And you just have to switch into your brain naturally, due to the training that you get in the British Army at the time, you just switch into that mode automatically. And it is instinctual. It just becomes second nature. That was the best thing about it. It just happened.
And when you're off duty and in your private moments and you're seeing all of this, are you ever thinking to yourself, what on earth is going on here? What am I doing here?
Yes, I did many a times. There were times where I've literally just been sat in the bunk and thinking, what the hell is going on over here? We never had any of this stuff back in Wales or back on the mainland.
But I mean, this is going on an hour's flight from your home, probably, in Wales.
That's right, yes. Because obviously I grew up on the west coast of Wales. I went to Aldershot to do all my training. And you hear about the different conflict zones you may get posted to as a medic. And all we had in the 70s was obviously Northern Ireland and Rhodesia. And you think, hang on, this is part of the UK. What the hell is going on? And that's when your brain starts trying to trick you. Well, should I really be here? Should I be in a place like this? But then when you start thinking about it, sometimes your brain can try and twist things around. And you can actually start getting caught up in the emotion of the situation. For example, your brain can then say, well, no, if these Catholics, as I assumed at the time, are trying to kill us, then why don't we kill them back? But there's an awful lot of history in Northern Ireland that you've got to understand before you can appreciate and understand what the situation is. So, yeah, it was very confusing at times, but most of the time you try and switch your brain off to any emotions or getting caught up in any views on political wranglings, etc., etc. So that's what you do. You just switch off to it and just focus on doing your job. End of story.
You've already mentioned that you then have a posting to Ballykelly, and it becomes a posting that's going to have a profound effect on your life. But before the date of the Drop-in-Well bombing, I mean, was the socialising there, going out at night, was it something that happened regularly? Had you been before?
put it this way, Ballykelly. The actual base is an old RAF base, and Ballykelly is a really, really quiet, pleasant... I wouldn't call it a village, I'd call it a town, the town of Ballykelly. And the relationship that the services, the armed forces, had in Ballykelly was just unbelievable. We could, even going back to the early 80s, and the late 70s, you could quite easily walk out of Shackleton Barracks, you could walk up and down the main street in uniform, even though it was highly unrecommended, you could still do that to nip over to one of the local shops where we used to go for breakfast every morning. If we didn't want to go into the cookhouse, but quite a few of us used to nip over there in our civvy clothes, go for a cooked breakfast over the road, because the relationship we had in Ballykelly with the local residents was just one unbelievable happy environment. No one ever expected anything to happen in Ballykelly. The only hassle we had, believe it or not, was with a local village 10 minutes down the road who were very pro-IRA. But in Ballykelly itself, it was very quiet, very serene, beautiful countryside around there, and it was a really nice atmosphere. Yes, we used to go out and socialise into places like the Drop-In Well and the Drummond Hotel, and every now and then, once in a blue moon, you would get a bomb scare whereby the barracks used to get informed, or the local police would be told that there was a bomb going to be planted, or there was a bomb in the Drop-In Well pub. So once that bomb scare was actually investigated, found to be false, etc., the place would be put out of bounds by the commanding officer. And then once the all clear was given, then it was back in bounds for us. And we used to drink with the locals, the Catholics, the Protestant girls and boys, and we never, ever had a problem in Ballykelly. It was really nice and quiet.
And the 6th of December, 1982, the 30th anniversary is coming up. On that night, of what you remember, everything before the bomb was as it would have been any other night you were there.
Yes, it was completely. Just a normal disco night. One of the lads that I worked with had actually passed a training course and been promoted. So a pile of us decided that, yes, we're going to go over to the Well, as we called it. And it was just a normal disco night. And it was quite normal for us to be mixing with the locals because no one clashed. There wasn't any, or you're British Army or you're Catholic or whatever. It was just a normal drinking night. We were just enjoying ourselves at the disco with our friends from Ballykelly and our friends from the barracks.
And as you remember it, what happened?
Right, this is the hard part. Right, there are only two incidents I can actually remember from that night. And for 30 years, I've tried to get the jigsaw pieces put in the middle. I have a jigsaw puzzle in my head, and I have the edging of the jigsaw puzzle. And that edging consists of my post into Ballykelly. I know that. That's the surrounding information. But that night, I remember I'd actually bought a round of drinks, and I put a tray on a table and said to the boy, said, right, won't be a minute, lads. I'm just going to the bog, as we called it, going to the loo. And I walked through the door of the toilet, and the door slammed behind me. And the next thing I know, I'm actually blown through the other side of the toilet. And within a matter of seconds, I'm one of the lucky ones. I wasn't badly injured, but within a matter of a second or two, your brain realizes what the hell has just happened. And luckily, I just had a small amount of rubble on top of me from what was left of the toilet. And I got out with the rubble, and literally within a millisecond, your brain, your survival brain and my medic brain kicked in. So my job then, once I checked, I was all right. Yes, I had cuts and bruises, but I could walk, I was breathing, I could just about see, excuse me, because obviously there's a pile of dust and rubble and things like that. So my medic brain just kicked in. So then it was just my job to try and help my comrades and the other people in the pub as well.
And there were, what, around, I think some of the reports suggest about 150 people or so in the pub that night?
Probably. I'll be honest, Joel, I don't know the exact figures. I've never known the exact figures. All I know are the number of fatalities, the approximate number of people that were injured, and some of the nature of the injuries. And those are things that I remember from the time, and there are other things I've learnt over the last 30 years.
So as you've dusted yourself down and you say there's not a large amount of rubble on top of you, and your medic instinct kicks in, what's the scene that's in front of you?
The only thing I can describe it is literally a scene from Hiroshima. There is literally nothing left. The only thing that is standing is the back end of the pub, because we obviously had the disco hall and we had the little shopping centre above us where I think we had the hairdressers, a florist. I can't remember what else was up there, but literally the pillars had been taken out by the explosives inside the actual disco room. And as a result of that, the whole of the shopping centre just came straight down on top of everyone. That is that plus the obvious immediate impact of the explosion. excuse me, which actually obviously killed a lot of people outright. But yeah, it was just a humongous, it literally looked like a dozen bulldozers had just gone straight in there and straight through the place.
Can you remember what you did, how you tried to tend to some of your colleagues?
This is one of the awkward things, Joe. In 2005, I was diagnosed with what they call combat PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And over the years, what has happened is my brain has actually shut down part of its memory banks. And so there's a very limited amount of information I can remember. But what I can remember is treating one particular casualty. And that particular casualty had specific injuries that I remember to this day. And it just so happens that for 25 years after that night, I had a recurring nightmare whereby I'd wake up screaming and shouting, not knowing if that casualty lived or died. And for 25 years, I believed it was one of my fellow soldiers. That was until December 2007, when I went back to Ballykelly for the first time for the 25th anniversary. And it wasn't until that weekend that, number one, I was able to put that nightmare to bed, because my wife, who was with me at the time, got talking to a local girl, and as soon as Sarah recalled the aspects of my nightmare, I was then asked to go and meet this young girl's auntie inside the pub we were in at the time. So I did, and I was asked to repeat what my nightmare was about to this lady, and as soon as I did, she literally collapsed on the floor in my arms, sobbing her heart out. And all I'm thinking is, bloody hell, Taff, what have you done? When she stood up and she's hugging me like hell, she actually then holds me arm's length and said, Steve, that wasn't a soldier. That was my sister. That was her sister, Nicola. And she lived for 13 years after that bombing. So that nightmare I've had for 25 years up until 2007, where I didn't know if that casualty lived or died, I actually, Sharon and the family were able to end that nightmare for me, because I then found out that the casualty I had worked on, that I remember working on, actually did survive. Because of the specific injuries to this casualty, when I spoke to the family, they confirmed that the injuries, because I know there was only one casualty that went to Altmagelvin Hospital with the specific type of injuries that this casualty had. And the specific type of treatment that was given to that casualty, I know what that treatment and the injuries are, and the family know, and they're the only people that were able to confirm. So I do know that the casualty wasn't, number one, it wasn't a soldier. It was actually a local civilian.
And what was it like when you heard that news in terms of a weight being lifted off your shoulders, given this recurring nightmare that you had had?
It was a huge, huge weight, because for 25 years I've had this recurring nightmare, and now all of a sudden a total stranger who I've never met before has actually been able to put an end to that nightmare and answer that question. And the question I wanted answering for 25 years, did that casualty live or die? And thankfully, they did survive.
You carried that burden for a long time, Steve, but you're involved with a charity now, Combat Stress, that is helping service personnel who have been in similar circumstances. You've been doing a bit of fundraising work for them as well recently, and it's something that's there for them that I'm sure, given your experience, you would urge other service personnel who maybe have similar flashbacks, similar circumstances, to use.
Yes, that's correct. There are still an awful lot of veterans out there who are hiding within themselves. They may not know who to turn to. They may not know that they're actually ill, because an awful lot of us who are diagnosed with psychological problems, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, we don't actually realize that we're ill. And when you do realize that something is actually wrong, you are then thrown into a situation. Well, yes, I'm ill. Right, where do I get the help from? And that's the sort of scenario I was placed into. So, yes, there are an awful lot of veterans out there who are suffering, who, number one, they may not know they're ill. It'll be the families and the friends who have noticed changes in them. And this will be veterans from World War II, and also some of the youngsters and the experienced guys coming back from places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Because obviously in recent years, the media have been made, and the public have been made, much more aware of the psychological injuries that we can suffer.